So it's, I guess, yeah, exactly what you were just saying. We want to try to create a panel. Unfortunately, SACOM had to leave, so... Yeah, exactly. I guess what we're thinking in terms of a panel is just a discussion around the ideas that we've been hearing. And so, yeah, if anyone has any questions, I mean...
Earth is the best material because we have, with Earth, you have 2 feet, 3 feet thick walls. That's really, really good to keep the heat in. That's your point, right? Keep the heat, trap the heat, keep the insulation. And wet, you said. For wet, you need really, really large overhangs. And if you look at all traditional buildings, you'll find that the roofs have very good overhangs. And even the last picture that you saw, you find the roof coming really out. But it's not a modern language. Overhangs are out of the question when you look at modern architecture. So so that's the thing. Architects would like to have clear lines, boxes. But that's not really climatic. So what we need is a response which is climatic. And we call it bioclimatic architecture. It's really to do with the past, learning from the our predecessors. Even where do you come from?
Ireland. The rain doesn't get
sometimes. It's a problem.
The other issue is we don't have a lot of sunlight, so when you feel dark inside, even during the day.
What did the people do in the past? What were the settlements like? What were the houses like?
Traditionally, it was stone.
And what was the quality of light? Was it pretty dark inside? Or?
Yeah, they would have been very small. But also, in those days, people would have spent a lot of money on the market.
I guess there are challenges that every bioclimatic, every climate, every zone of the world, there are specific challenges to building. And if we were to look at settlements that are really old, one would find a lot of solutions, maybe not all the solutions, but a lot of solutions to a lot of these problems. Like you said, there's this one problem in such a settlement that it's very dark inside. So that is the challenge that technology, modern technology, must try and crack, you know, in a way. Like, how is it that we can bring more light into a house that is built using natural materials, using local efforts? How is it that we can get more light in? So that is a pertinent question within the framework of integral sustainability. I feel so. There are many ways of solving that. Innovatively use glass in the roof. Why not? Or do some other things. So, the problem, I think, what we normally have is that we don't ask the pertinent questions within the framework of sustainability when we start building. So, normally we assume that we can do just about anything, which is what modern architecture is about. That if you've read Fountainhead by Ayn Rand, you will know that, you know, it's like, has any of you read?
Yeah.
It's about, you know, starting from scratch, basically. But that's not really the case.
The town head.
It strikes me that your approach and Sat Prem's approach are quite different.
And especially your last comment regarding Le Corbusier's structure. If even comparing the energy of the two of you in your approach, when in your approach is an approach to community and building from the heart, and Sadhguru's approach strikes me as being highly technological. And if you look at the amount of production that is there, I think you get a sense of what drives architecture in the world today. It's a kind of strongly focused energy to construct massively, because
that's the need
of societies. And you can see in Oroville that the, you know, Sadhana Forest is doing the kinds of buildings that you did at Sadhana Forest and that we all did here 40 years ago. But today what we're doing is Citadine and those high-rise apartments, which even though they are pressed mud constructions, they're not being done from the heart. They're being done technologically in order to provide habitation for large numbers of people, for the most part. So where is the balance that needs to be found between these approaches, if there needs to be a balance, or is it in fact the case that the technological approach is the only one which is viable?
There are many different approaches that many people are following, including Supreme. And Supreme, in fact, has a very relevant point, like which you also mirrored, that we need to house so many people, and earth is the most viable material. And if we do it this way, we can create stable environments and fast, really fast. You know, and that's really the thrust of his work. And I really respect that, because that's very important for especially responding to disasters, where he does a lot of work on that, you know, responding to tsunamis, earthquakes, floods. We need to build really fast. We need to have efficient living units which will work. And maybe that's really a thrust which Orville also needs to look at, because there's a lot of housing that needs to be built. So I feel a certain relevance to that approach, and as long as that comes within the sphere of community, you know, that it comes the approach where you're doing things fast and where you're trying to make solutions fast, replicable and for the future, as long as it involves all the users, involves all the people who are being affected in a process, it would still be my approach, you know, that it would still have heart. You know, if, even though it may be very little time that the consultation happens or the discussion happens, but it would still be this approach that I've been recommending, that we need to have a collaborative system, we need to work together, work with our hands, and that would be a prerequisite towards taking that leap. So I think there is validity for all these approaches, as long as we have these basic, what do you call that? Some people call it relational physics, in terms of, I don't want to use jargon, but the basic relations of these different things, different factors at play. If all of them come together, then I guess it should be the path. So anybody's path could be the integral way.
I was just thinking maybe we could use the word community, because you know, all these approaches are going to be here in Oregon.
Yeah.
And that's a fact.
Yes.
And you know, just yesterday when I cycled past Luminosity, which is that, you know, huge concrete box. There was David, the architect, out there, and he's explaining to me how it's totally water self-sufficient. So they collect all the rainwater, the rainwater, you know, first drink and all of that, then they use the gray water system and water the plants, so they take care of the water, and they're off the grid with their solar. And, you know, and the people go there, and they meditate in the rooms, and everybody's kind of involved in the process. So I don't think we can, in Oracle, we can get into this thing, well, Zafram's approach, or David's approach, or my approach, which would be, you know, be much more eco-efficient. So we get down to these questions of, okay, how do we work in a process together where we're not conflictual or confrontational all the time, which has been the history of Oracle. And certain things have been built in Oracle because people have more clout or more money or something like that, rather than the community process. So I think maybe the nature of this seminar is to try to find those ways, because we have all the ideas. I don't think we're in no shortage of ideas. You can use permaculture, you can use anything you want, any system. But we have them all here. But then the other part is how to put it together, how to get the neutrality that Rod spoke about. And I would say that, you know, maybe as we go out of here, you did just say you didn't want to end with compost toilets, but I think that's a very good place to end. You know, that everybody goes out of here with a sense of what is a compost toilet, why am I not using one, how can I use one, and what am I going to do it?
And when will Oracle do it, have public composting toilets in public places. I wanted to have a different take on what Rod was saying, the two differences and two approaches. And this throws me back to another definition of sustainability. The students had a reading where it said sustainability is not just environmentalism. It's environmentalism plus literally that leap or a mind shift to a different worldview. And you have to also talk about how you restructure your society and your economy. Brian Swim was also touching on that. Because what struck me was Satprem also uses community. He uses unskilled laborers. He keeps talking about this team of 150 unskilled people. The difference is they are paid, and Sadhana Forest volunteers were not paid. And so somewhere I just would like to, it's just a comment that we keep that in mind, that we also need to restructure economies as we go into the sustainability.
And Becca?
I have some questions about bamboo. How much bamboo did you use, and what did you what do you do to make it bigger extent when you're using the print, making print, and is any experiment for work all of it to make bamboo much more stronger and bigger extent, or and is it very local and cheap here to use bamboo, and for city and for dockers also?
Firstly, just respond. I think I stressed too much on that bamboo, so I'm sorry about that. But bamboo is not the future, you know. I think there's a lot of hype around it, particularly because we are still not there where we are growing bamboo sustainably. This bamboo that we, for instance, that we got is from a forest. So you know, from a forest near Kerala. So in a way, it's not sustainable. To answer your question about durability, and so there is a seasoning process where you dip it in water, let the starch inside it leach out, so that insects don't find it attractive to bore. And once it's in concrete, the insects cannot reach it. So that's once you're putting it in a more stronger structure, then it doesn't get attacked. So the primary use of bamboo here is to substitute steel, because steel is a very unsustainable, clearly unsustainable material. It uses huge amounts of energy, huge amounts of transport costs, huge amounts of water. So anyway, I think the material that I would have liked to highlight is Pamira. I think what came across is bamboo. So Pamira is completely ignored. It's a tree that's all over the place. You cut a leaf, branch, leave it on the ground for months, and termites don't attack it. And I've never seen any wood that can be kept on the ground, on the earth, freely in Auroville context, without the termites attacking it. So, and it's very strong. When the dried stem, we just put one dried stem across two bricks, and we got one man to stand on it. It just bent a little, but it didn't break. So it's really strong, and so we felt that it could be used for roofing, it could be used for walling, it could be, and I think we need to make it more and more popular, because that's something we can right away use from the site, and we're hoping it adds to thermal mass, it increases insulation, it does a lot for the roof, for instance. Ferrocement channels have this big drawback of lack of thermal mass. Others have used this word thermal mass. I don't know whether everybody understands. Thermal mass is the actual volume of material in the building component that resists heat, basically. It's the mass that protects you from heat. If you have more mass, it takes longer to heat up and longer to radiate inside. You know? So if you have a roof which is heavy, really thick, with like you saw subframe slides, there were these lawns and grass and really thick. The thermal mass is very high, and it protects you from the solar radiation coming in. So similarly with ferrocement, the thickness is very less, so it heats up very fast and it starts radiating heat inside. So the solution is to make a sandwich or something. We are going in the same language. Using Pamira, bamboo, have a thick roof, have biomass inside, so have very little cement and steel, but have a thick layer of biomass inside, which will protect you from the heat. So it can be used for roofing, or anything. So, sorry, does that answer your... I'd like to withdraw a little, and maybe if people could talk across, maybe.
Bamboo is not certainly the cheaper one.
Yeah, it's cheaper than steel.
It's all related. It's costlier than Pamira.
Pamira is free.
Well, if you want to, Orville is actually going to enter into some experimentation with bamboo, because there are some new bamboos that will grow like 60 centimeters a day.
Yeah.
And there are different types of bamboos, because bamboo is actually a fabulous thing in many ways. There are many species, and you can eat bamboo and build with it, and you can do almost anything. So I think it's a very important field for Oregon to explore. And many bamboos are growing wild here, too.
I think the culture of planting bamboo needs to be encouraged, and that is the beginning. No?
And I was going to say, there's an experimental structure being built right now that some of our students are working on, and some of the folks from Earth Institute are building this out of bamboo. I don't know if any of you want to speak to that or talk about it, how that process is going.
I've only been there a couple weeks, but it's more or less a mixture of earth materials and bamboo. They're stressing on the bamboo, but the beams and rafters and everything are composed of bamboo, but the slats going on the roof that are going to hold the eventual roof that's going to be on there are made out of 12-foot beetle wood. I'm not sure what the local name is.
What is it?
Pacamarin. But yeah, so bamboo structure, and then wall panels are an earthen plaster over top of bamboo rope, kind of woven into a mesh. It's a basic process of that.
I should hope that the monsoons don't come too soon.
And the roof is going to be a layer of PVC, like just plastic sheeting, going on top of the roof, then covered with more earth and plaster, and then covered with limestone or lime plaster.
I'm confused about this use of cement, as far as I understand it, in a sustainable way. But there's something reason it like this. Does anyone know, like, the composition of it? You don't have to deteriorate or get back to have some environment. But I actually think that's a concern.
I'm concerned as well. We are in a slow progression towards sustainability. So, we try to tackle one thing at a time, like take steel out, put bamboo in. We've had this history of ferrocement use, so we're trying to build a technology where we can make it more efficient, more better, using biomass. And of course, the future is going back to the earth, so without cement, without stabilizing, maybe using lime. That could be really challenging. But as the frame said, lime needs a lot of clay, so how do we handle it? You know, we don't have much clay in the soil, so if we have to transport a lot of clay from paddy fields far away and displace the livelihoods of farmers, then probably we're not doing anything sustainable by using lime. So it's a complex thing, so we need to, I think the key is to look at the site, we observe the site, and what we can get from it. As Supreme does, he digs out the like realization project. He's dug out a huge pile of earth from the foundation. Especially for making those tunnels, you need to go 3.5 meters deep. So he's dug out a huge load of earth, and all that earth he's using to make bricks. It's really sustainable. Like you're using all the material from the site itself to make the walls. You know, it's something that's the future. Although he's using cement. But if you look at the total footprint, in terms of carbon footprint, whatever, transport costs of everything, you'll find that maybe lime was not the way to go. It's like a site-specific thing.
And the goal is to minimize, like you said, to minimize the use as much as possible, but at this point, I mean, it's very versatile and useful materials. There's all this knowledge of like what's happened thousands of years ago, that structures are still existing. Right?
Mm-hmm.
There's all this technology.
We are building
market
like that.
Dynamics.
Yeah. People are building a lot of natural buildings without any cement.
They are.
Yeah. Right now, I mean, a lot of the natural building books and workshops and sites right now that are being constructed are without any cement use. And I think the problem with cement is the toxicity of it and the fact that it can't be disposed of in the environment. It's really toxic. And so, and I think the extraction of it too is really harmful. So, yeah. But they're finding that cob and things like that are actually stronger than cement. And then in earth, and they're more durable, they move more, they're more flexible as well. So in earthquake zones and things like that, oftentimes the natural buildings are the only ones left standing at the end of it. So it's really neat. So.
Yes, I hope we don't have any problem of ventilation or open heat, but we do have a key problem of, can it be, can something be done for the natural air conditioning,
The typical challenge with this earth tunnel system is that the humidity levels should not be very high. So, unfortunately, in this area, because we're close to the sea, humidity levels are pretty sort of, what is it exactly? I don't
know. Almost 70-80%.
So that's the challenge. Even Supreme said he's doing it as a test to see whether actually the temperature would drop. And if it drops, he'll apply it for other buildings. So that technology may not be applicable even in Sarna.
And khas gardens are used in most of the parts in India. But I just wonder where they are.
Those are used in dry areas in North India, like Mughal architecture. They would hang these khas. Khas is this grass, you know. You make grass mats and you hang it by your windows and you keep it wet. So as the wind blows through it, it cools your room down. And this technology was used by Mughal rulers, but this was done in dry areas. No? So the drying, the cooling happens much faster.
Did you say it's a grass or a root?
Yeah, it would be a root.
There is also, you know, there is the actual temperature and there is what we call the feels-like temperature. And in cold countries, you know what it feels like with the wind chill factor. Here you know what it feels like with the humidity factor. So it always feels a few more degrees cooler than it actually, hotter than it actually is. And there is one experiment in CSR about using dehumidification. It has the effect of air conditioning. It's still at an experimental stage, but all they do is they suck out the humidity from that room and it drops it down. The feel temperature is dropped down by 5 to 6 degrees. Yeah. I'm not very sure of the technology, but it is by this guy Alok from Oro, who is quite an innovator. And I know it has been applied in other parts of the world, and he just came up with a local innovation. But yeah, try it when you're at CSR, ask to check out the dehumidifier.
It's a coolant-based air conditioning system, but the loads, air conditioning load is dramatically reduced when you remove a lot of humidity from it. So you attach a dehumidifier, you attach a smaller load air conditioner, and then you come with an 80% energy saving.
So it requires
It requires a
it requires
It's a traditional air conditioning system, but with a dehumidifier.
Is that what Alok is also?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know whether he's experimented with coolant, if he's used like non-freon water coolants. I don't know.
What about like geothermal?
Let's
see. All of these systems utilize the same technology to either part of the cooling process involves dehumidification, and so I think all of these technologies involve the same basic concept of moving cool, kind of cooling the air down to the room humidity. And
I have seen the houses in Oroville where they have a bathtub in the living room. It's open to the garden and there is a bathtub so people can just sit and be cool.
Yeah, that's probably the solution for some, and that's already in action.
And geothermal systems are considerably more efficient than a standard air conditioning system, but it's still the same. No, it's just still the same technology that's utilizing. It's just using the Earth's temperature to do the same thing that to run the system.
I was following my own question from before, and it seems like when you said that we're moving slowly towards sustainability, maybe that's the key, actually, because if there is a shift towards regional hands-on solutions to problems, and then when those solutions are found, to implement them on a massive scale, then you're combining the two approaches, and that may be the methodology that's required, because if you look back historically at the beginning here, some of us used peat and palmyra leaves and bamboo and so on, but at the same time, those buildings down in Aspiration. Concrete, pyramids and mushrooms and this and that, those were built in the beginning before the idea of sustainability had even occurred, I think. You mentioned the date when it was first with the concept.
Yeah, it was one of the early definitions is limits to growth, 1972.
Okay.
From the Club of Rome, right. The Meadows, yeah. And then
so it's important to realize that the concept of sustainability itself is fairly recent. And what the mother said about Oroville was that it should move towards being self-sustaining. And what's really wrong with society prior to its fall is that it will do anything to sustain itself, whatever its rate of consumption or whatever its values. It's like human society wants to sustain itself and maintain the status quo while doing that. So sustainability is quite a different concept from being self-sustaining. Self-sustaining doesn't have to take into consideration any amount of impact except the limits to what it can use. So maybe this sort of bioregional hands-on focus of consciousness is really the beginning of the principle of sustainability.
So I guess unless anyone has any more comments in the last.
Well, could I just say, what Rod says is, completely correct, but it seems that the only way these things work is actually you get individuals who would go out, like Sakharam, for example, and they do these small experiments at first, they build out in the forest. And then these become models that inspire other people and keep the process moving. Because I'm still going back to that thing, and we have the technology, we have the idea, but we don't do it. So that was one of the questions that Rod posed. We talked, and then the only thing that happens usually is people look for market solutions where we can make some money off that process. But nothing else happens. So how do we make the other thing happen?
And it's like we have a lot of Fridays, we have movies and people come and stuff. And I've talked to many people who have lived there throughout the years, and most of them have done the same thing. It's like, it's beautiful, it's nice, but I just can't live this way. Mm-hmm. It's too open, the passion is just always falling down on you, this and that, And I think it's a lot of it has to do with just comfort. Mm-hmm. We don't have electricity outside of like solar panels for computers and lights and stuff like that. We don't have fans, we don't have like a lot of these, conveniences that are in a lot of the other houses and areas. So, I find that that's a major like hurdle to overcome is just people I don't even want to say giving up, but like, changing their ideas of what comfort zone is. And
well, the same thing happened in Oroville, because we all started out like Southern Forest. And then everybody wanted a little more comfort, trying to go to the fridge or trying to get some electricity so you could have more things. And then here we are where we are now.
The key term in evolutionary theory and also in the shift of consciousness is habit.
Sure.
People get into a mode of habitual behavior that is somehow satisfactory. And it's very difficult to shift out of that habitual mode. And in fact, in biological theory, species themselves maintain themselves through habit. Mm. So it's not so much ideas, about what we would like, but it's an actual functioning in a certain range of sensation and rehabilitation of energy and so on that creates a comfortable habit. So if a mode of living that is sustainable and meets at least approximates a certain level of habitual expectation, then there's going to be a better chance of implementing it. Otherwise, it's going to be necessary to make some difficult choices, to gear down the vital world expectations, which are known conventionally as habits. So that's where the psychological element overrides the technological and the ethical and the theoretical and all of those other ways of thinking that we've been hearing.
And that's where I see it all coming back to that balance and all this concept of, and what we call it, tetra arising. So all of these different parts have to occur at the same time. If you don't satisfy this psychological, emotional aspect of whatever, the technology or the way society's functioning, it's still not going to work. If it doesn't meet the community needs, then it's not going to function. And so, but also, that's where I'm seeing kind of what you're talking about and also what Saffron was talking about kind of coming together is, this kind of a larger system, there needs to be housing, so that needs to be met. That's a kind of a larger need that needs to be filled, but also, kind of bringing these ideas, merging these ideas is crucial, I think, because it needs to consider community as well and kind of what's going on internally. And it's just this balance of bringing those together, and I think that's the strength of looking at it in an individual way. It's 12:30 right now, a couple minutes, so I wanted to close out unless I think it's been a really excellent series of presentations and conversation. So thank you, everyone.